Today's show for November 26th. I always appreciate it when what is usually a science article is well written and with a poetic twist. Spectacular conjunction. This story begins tonight with a sunset stroll and ends with a best sky show of the year, a spectacular three-way conjunction of Venus, Jupiter, and the crescent moon. At the end of today, when the horizon is turning red and the zenith is cobalt blue, step outside and look southwest. You'll see Venus and Jupiter beaming side by side through the twilight. Glittering Venus is absolutely brilliant, and Jupiter is nearly as bright as Venus. Together, they're dynamite. Add another stick of TNT and voila, it's tomorrow. Go outside at the same time tomorrow and look again. You'll be amazed at how much the Venus-Jupiter gap is closed. The two planets are converging, not in the slow motion typical of heavenly phenomena, but in a headlong rush, almost a full degree, two full moon widths per night. As the gap shrinks, the beauty increases. On November 29th, the two planets will be less than 3 degrees apart, and you'll think to yourself, surely it can't get any better than this. And then it will. On November 30th, a slender 10% crescent moon leaps up from the horizon to join the show. The delicate crescent hovering just below Venus-Jupiter will have cameras clicking around the world. December 1st is the best night of all. The now 15% crescent moon moves in closer to form an isosceles triangle with Venus and Jupiter as opposing vertices. Don't you love it when I talk dirty like that? The three brightest objects in the sky, night sky, will be gathered so tightly together you can hide them all behind your thumb held at arm's length. This celestial triangle will be visible from all parts of the world, even from light-polluted cities. People in New York and Hong Kong will see it just as clearly as astronomers watching from remote mountaintops. Only cloudy weather or a midnight sun in Antarctica can spoil the show. Although you can see the triangle with naked eyes, indeed you can't miss it, a small telescope will make the evening even more enjoyable. In one quick triangular sweep, you can see the moons and cloud belts of Jupiter, the gibbous phase of Venus, which will be 69% full, and craters and mountains on the moon. It's a grand tour you won't soon forget. Finally, look up from the eyepiece and run your eyes across the moon. Did you see a ghostly image of the full moon inside the bright horns of the crescent? That's called Earthshine, or sometimes the Da Vinci glow, because Leonardo da Vinci was the first person to explain it. Sunlight hits Earth and ricochets to the moon, casting a sheen of light across the dark lunar terrain. By itself, a crescent moon with Earthshine is one of the loveliest sights in the heavens. Add Venus and Jupiter, and, well, it's time to stop reading and go mark your calendar. My commentary for today, November 26th. I'm sure having trouble with that date. Well, as Barack Obama puts his team together, one thing is perfectly clear. There will be no fundamental change in the absurd house of cards known as the American economic system. His choices for all officials in charge of monetary policies are all chosen from the same tired old sources. There has not even been one hint of forming a task force to even look at the possibility of fundamental changes in an obviously failed system. Obama will continue the Bush-Cheney tradition of presiding over a series of band-aids in a continuing attempt to hoodwink the world into supporting Wall Street, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the other hosts of shysters who profit from common people's miseries. Wall Street wins, the people lose. We get an Oreo president and more of the same. To be fair, though, he never promised us otherwise. At least in the realm of finance and the economy, Barack Obama is not liberal and he's not progressive. He is, hopefully, a kinder, more gentle, good old boy. And BBC News reported this morning that he's chosen Paul Volcker for some office or other. Volcker was the head of the Federal Reserve System. So, again, it's more of the same. Next item. This philosophic gem from Mark Morford of the San Francisco Chronicle-Gate. Happy people usually only want a long walk, some sunshine, maybe a margarita and a good book, and messy oral sex every hour or two. That's easy. It's unhappy people who really drive the economy. Unhappy people make capitalism go. They're the ones that buy all the stuff. This is why we like to create so many of them. Next item. This is from naturalnews.com. FDA scientists revolt against corrupt Food and Drug Administration officials. It's by Mike Adams, the Natural News editor. A group of scientists working in the FDA's Center for Devices and Radiological Health Division has revolted against the corrupt managers of its own department, accusing them of committing crimes by claiming, quote, "There is excessive documentary evidence that managers at CDRH, or the Center for Devices and Radiological Health, they've corrupted and interfered with the scientific view of medical devices." The letter from the FDA's own scientists goes on to say, "It is evident that managers at CDRH have deviated from FDA mission to identify and address underlying problems with medical devices before they can cause irreparable harm, and this deviation has placed the American people at risk." Close quote. By the way, this article does not mention what devices the people were up in arms about. Congressman John Dingell, chairman of the committee which received the letter, went on to charge that these FDA bureaucrats approved or cleared medical device applications in gross violation of laws and regulations. None of this, of course, surprised readers of Natural News. Note, too, that the mainstream media has virtually ignored this story. You might think that a revolt of FDA scientists against their criminal bosses would be a huge story, worthy of front-page treatment at USA Today or the Washington Post. Right? Nope. Only the New York Times bothered to report the story. Next item. California Supreme Court rules Proposition 215 caregivers must do more than just supply marijuana. In a blow to medical marijuana providers, the California Supreme Court ruled that defendants are not entitled to a defense as Prop 215 caregivers if their primary role is only to supply marijuana to patients. The court writing, quote, "We hold that a defendant whose caregiving consists principally of supplying marijuana and instructing on its use, and who otherwise only sporadically took some patients to medical appointments, cannot qualify as a primary caregiver under the Act. According to the court, the wording of the Act implies a caretaking relationship directed at the core survival needs of a seriously ill patient, not just one single pharmaceutical need. In particular, it excludes its use by medical marijuana buyers clubs, retail dispensaries, and delivery services." My comment: one must assume this also excludes a gardener who claims they're growing for a club. Cal Normal coordinator Dale Gerringer made the following comment: "This decision highlights the inadequacy of California's current medical marijuana supply system. The law needs to allow for professional licensed growers, as with it does with other medicinal herbs." Next item. Interesting how the slant of two articles published the same day in Sacramento Bee move my emotions and judgments in opposite directions. First story. The situation. Some high school kid in the Sacramento area was ordered by the court to change foster homes, and thus he had to change schools. He's on the football team, and when someone discovered his transfer paperwork was not in order, his team was instructed by the league commissioner to forfeit two games he'd played in, and that knocked the team out of the playoffs. It seems there exists an organization called the National Center for Youth Law, and they intervene and even go to court for students. Well, they went to court on this issue, and they won. And the league commissioner, Pete Sacco, said his school team is now restored to the playoffs. Now comes the good part. Of perhaps greater significance, Sacco said CIF officials would revise section bylaws. Though he stated he's still convinced the CIF's documentation requirements regarding transfer students were reasonable and do not serve as unnecessary barriers for foster youths, Sacco added, with his right finger punching the air, that the court's decision is where the passion is, where the heart tugs. Believe me, I understand that. So that was my feel-good story for today. Unfortunately, according to another article at the same day in the same sports section, and according to the majority opinion of readers writing in, it seems that if Sacco had used his heart instead of his head, he would have accepted the clerical error, left the matter alone, and not caused the court case in the first place. So after these somewhat opposing views, I'm an emotional wreck. I think it illustrates how our thoughts and emotions can be so easily altered by the way a news story is presented. Next item, this just in. General Motors, now before Congress with its hands out begging for save me money, is finally showing some fiscal responsibility and common sense. They've announced they will no longer pay Tiger Woods to be in their Buick TV commercials. Way to go, GM. Now, if they only would go back to producing their excellent electric car, we might be truly impressed. Next item. I got an email from Congressman John Conyers. Have exciting news to share with you. H.R. 676, my bill for universal single-payer health care, has a new home on the web. It's www.johnconyers.com/healthcare. So at least one Democrat is making good on a promise. Way to go, John Conyers. And if those of you that are interested in supporting him and his attempt for universal single-payer health care, go to johnconyers.com/healthcare. Next item. A listener sent me an email with the following. Subject, 1929 and now. Back during the 1929 financial crash, it was said that when confronted with the news of their firms and clients' financial ruin, some Wall Street stockbrokers and bankers jumped from their office windows and committed suicide. Many people were said to almost feel a little sorry for them. But now it's 2008, and the attitude has changed somewhat. And then the email has a photo of the stock market building on Wall Street with a large handmade sign in front of it. The sign reads, "Jump, you effers." Okay, a couple of articles on the proposed bailout of GM and the other automotive giants. This one's titled Idiots and Bailouts. It's by Dave Lindorf, writing in Smirking Chimp. It's a safe bet that within the next several months, Congress will vote to bail out General Motors. It will be a colossal boondoggle involving probably upwards of $50 billion when it's through, and it'll fail in the end. The reason is before our eyes. This bloated megacorporation is being run by idiots. For years, and it has become evident to everyone that oil prices were going to soar because demand has been exceeding both production and supply and will continue to do so, it has been obvious that to succeed, a car company had to offer well-made cars that could demonstrate high gas mileage. GM, perhaps more than any other company, ignored that reality and has been paying the price, watching its share of the car market wither. Now the company, worth about what Starbucks used to be worth, its stock now down to where it was at the depths of the Great Depression, has bet the farm on a new car, the Volt, which it promises will, 2 years from now, be able to go all of 40 miles purely on electric power. It'll have a motor, too, and not a small one, but rather one the size of what you get in a typical conventional Honda Civic, 1.4 liters. That motor won't drive the car. Rather, it would keep charging the Volt's huge lithium-ion battery, so the car could keep going for a few hundred miles. Wow. The management wizards at GM obviously didn't do much driving. Don't do much driving. If they did and found themselves in a typical commuter traffic, they'd see that maybe 90% of the cars or more have only one person in them. Occasionally, they'd see a passenger. On a typical 45-minute trip from the burbs into Philadelphia at rush hour, I can count the number of cars I see with three or more people in them on my fingers. So why is GM making the Volt as a full-size 4- or 5-passenger car? That's not where the market for an electric car is. What is needed is a 2-seater little car. Besides, GM is trying to make an electric family car. They've made something so big that if they're lucky, they'll be able to get it to go 40 miles on electric drive only, but at a cost of in excess of $40,000 and perhaps much higher, which will put it out of almost everyone's reach. This car is destined to be a bust. And yet, because President-elect Obama will want to win Michigan next election, and because congressional Democrats don't want to be seen as ignoring the fate of GM's workers, GM will be bailed out, and the Volt will be funded right through to its introduction and subsequent disaster in the market. I'm not opposed to the idea of government support of industry, but that support has to involve government input or even control over decision-making. Maybe GM wouldn't make much profit on a little electric commuter car, but a little 2-seater electric commuter car would have a huge impact on reducing the output of hydrocarbons into the atmosphere, particularly if efforts were made to increase solar and wind-generated electricity. A small electric commuter car would also massively reduce the amount of oil the U.S. imports, making a major contribution to reducing the nation's trade deficit. These are results that justify a bailout. Making an overpriced electric family car is not. At this point, since the Democrats in Congress and the White House are congenitally incapable of imagining a state-owned or partially state-owned enterprise, it would be better to just let GM go under, and maybe Ford too, if it comes to that. The pieces could be sold off and allowed to sink and swim on their own. Maybe one of those smaller, more entrepreneurial fragments would see the wisdom of developing what the public really needs. The truth is that the entrepreneurs over at Tesla, a startup company in California, have already made that car, a high-performance two-seater commuter car that can go 200 miles on a charge and that does not need an auxiliary engine. Their problem is that small size and too little capital have forced them to pump it up into a high-priced luxury show-off item for rich people, costing $100,000. If they were to team up with a GM spinoff, say Saturn, they could make a stripped-down version of that baby and crank out 100,000 of them to start up at a price ordinary people could afford. Meanwhile, regarding those poor auto workers, they have a legitimate complaint. While Republicans like to blame the auto industry's problems on them, saying they have demanded too much pay and too much in health care benefits, it's not their fault the GM and Ford executives have been stupid and greedy and short-sighted. Besides, the high wages and benefits that the UAW won over decades of bitter struggle helped to set standards that raised the wages of all workers across the nation. But let's do the math. There are about 125,000 unionized hourly workers at the two companies. For a lousy $8.7 billion, every one of those people could receive a $70,000 buyout from Congress. Double that if you want to give them 2 years to adjust and find new work at an electric car plant or something else. That would cost $17 billion, or less than half of what the doomed bailout of GM is going to end up costing. And of course, with the rest of us suffering from the massive mismanagement of the nation's economy by its corporate leaders and their puppets in Washington, there's no reason why our tax dollars should be subsidizing those particular workers at that high a level. After all, companies are failing and will be failing all over the place without such largesse. Besides, if the bailout goes ahead, all it will do is delay the time these workers will be out on the street anyhow. The point is, however, there are more cost-effective ways to help out workers and failing businesses than to have the government simply subsidize the continued operation of enterprises that have been destroyed by management. In truth, all the talk in Congress and in the Obama camp about rescuing jobs is just a cover for bailouts that are really aimed at rescuing managers and investors, not workers. David Lindhoff, writing in Smirking Chimp. Here's another one. This one's even harsher. Lavishing billions on old technology where true innovation is scorned. It's by Pierre Tristan, also writing in Smirking Chimp. Wasn't that long ago that Ford could give its stockholders a 215% return on investment in just 3 years. At that time, Ford was clearing $12,000 in profits on each Ford Expedition and $15,000 on each Navigator, and making 1,040 of those SUVs a day for after-tax profits of $2.4 billion. So much for labor costs dragging down Detroit. Instead, it was a case of stock profits blinding innovation. Ford stock peaked at a little more than $37 a share in 99. The stock now is threatening to dip below a buck a share. And Ford is the least diseased of the big three automakers. Their problem isn't gas prices, or labor costs, or the economy, all of which have been part of doing business for a century. Their problem is in too many of their products. GM spends about $4,400 on advertising per vehicle sold, only a little more than Ford and Chrysler. Toyota, by comparison, spends a little over $1,000. Nevertheless, Toyota this year is expected to overtake GM as the world leader in market share. The market is telling American auto manufacturers something. They're making too much stuff people no longer want to buy. Maybe the market can put up with one company doing that, but three? Taxpayers ought to be telling auto manufacturers something, too. Either change your product or let us spend tax dollars on more promising ventures. There's nothing inherently wrong in government bailouts. Private companies get them all the time. They just call it government contracting. What would Lockheed, General Dynamics, United Technologies, and even Boeing be without the Pentagon bailing them out regularly? There'd be nothing wrong with a bailout of Detroit that was attached to a set of conditions, like a 50 or 100 mile per gallon car by 2015, and an affordable, fully electric powered car by the same date. But Detroit isn't interested in moving out of its dinosaur digs. Fine, Americans love another museum, but they worship their innovators. Look at Henry Ford. The guy was an anti-Semite. He was Big Brother's father when it came to meddling in employees' private lives, and he had a soft spot for Hitler. Yet he's still revered as an American hero. So I was surprised to read Daniel Lyons, Newsweek's technology columnist, heaping scorn on Tesla Motors, the private venture company building an all-electric car that gets 200 miles to the charge and goes from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, which is faster than a Porsche. There's been infighting at the company, a lawsuit here and there, money ran short, the car's over budget, yet the company is producing 10 cars a week and has 1,200 orders for a vehicle that costs $109,000. For a prototype to be selling at barely twice the cost of a luxury internal combustion engine clunker is hugely promising. So why the scorn? So untimely when Barack Obama and the green gurus keep echoing the public's craving for the next automotive breakthrough that reduces oil's tyranny. If anything, Tesla-like projects are where the government should be pouring its billions. Yet the country's mindset is nowhere near that sort of investment. Lyons' arguments are striking for their familiarity. They're bleed-through from the anti-government rhetoric that for the past three decades has been poisoning discussions of how to move the country forward. It doesn't matter that Tesla is one of those potentially revolutionizing innovations. It's late and over budget, has gone through loads of redesigns, still has bugs, and at $109,000 costs more than originally planned, in Lyons' condemning words. This for a startup getting no government backing. Perspective would help. If a $25 billion bailout for Detroit Reptilian Museum isn't a scandal, here's another. The government has invested more than $65 billion on a jet fighter, the F-22, that was designed two decades ago to fight an enemy that no longer exists. The F-22 is also redundant because the military is developing the F-35, which is the more versatile joint strike fighter. The new one they're developing will cost $121 million a plane. The old one, the one that's obsolete, costs $350 million a plane. It's wildly over budget. Of course, so is the F-35. The country doesn't need both. Dozens of senators have tried to kill the F-22, including John McCain. But it has its lobbyists, so it carries on, while the Tesla, whose entire development costs were less than half the cost of a single F-22, struggles against snickers and scorn because it didn't get it right on the first try. Maybe the Tesla is not the answer, but an electric car is certainly part of the answer, if energy independence is a goal. The Tesla shows that the goal is within reach, but not if Detroit keeps hijacking investment dollars to nowhere, the Pentagon keeps burning billions for glorified useless wings, and innovative companies actually doing something right get clobbered for falling behind on delivering a miracle. Pierre Tristan, writing in Smirking Chimp. The time is 12:32. The station is KVMR FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamberlain. The next article is from Smirking Chimp. It's by Linda Milzano. It's entitled U.S. Citizen Diplomats Arrive in Iran, Invited by Ahmadinejad. In an effort to establish peaceful diplomacy with the government and people of Iran, and to model for the new Obama administration the power of cooperative goodwill, three highly regarded American peacemakers have ventured to Iran. Code Pink co-founders Jody Evans and Medea Benjamin, along with former Army Colonel and decorated Foreign Service diplomat Ann Wright, are visiting Iran on visas coordinated by the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which similarly organized the September 24th meeting in New York City between civilian leaders of the American peace movement and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. In that historic citizen diplomacy gathering, the Iranian president met with approximately 120 representatives from American peace and social justice organizations, where over the course of 2 hours, he took unfiltered questions from the groups. The woman of Code Pink, who traveled extensively on missions of peace, asked why the organization's founders were repeatedly denied visas to Iran. Ahmadinejad promised to remedy the situation and provide the woman their visas. The visas to Iran were issued on Monday. Evans stated, "We've come to deepen our work as citizens, diplomats, to model the type of diplomacy we hope to see from our new government. With the Bush administration's unrepentant militarism over the past 8 years, preferring destruction over discussion and war over words, and with Bush refusing to meet with his contrived opponents unless antagonistic preconditions were met, it's fallen upon citizen diplomats to pursue and model the adult diplomacy this nation needs." Medea Benjamin noted the following, "We hope the Obama administration will begin direct talks with Iran without preconditions. On this visit to Iran, we're modeling the policy we would like to see. We're meeting with pro- and anti-government groups, with religious and secular people, with environmentalists, women's groups, a wide swath of the Iranian people. We hope to take their message back to the U.S. and find creative ways to expand people-to-people ties. Our motto is, let's talk, which has tremendous resonance among Iranians who are all anxious to promote dialogue and avoid war. Indeed, Kopink's current campaign, directed at President-elect Obama, is simply called Let's Talk. It's a wide-ranging invitation to the incoming president to be all communicative and all inclusive. It calls upon Mr. Obama to be the great communicator he's capable of being, and to use his formidable skills to dialogue with all the world's leaders, absent the egocentric preconditions of his predecessor. Let's Talk is similarly a resounding invitation to the president-elect to meet with the individual members of peace and social justice organizations who worked so hard to elect him. It calls upon Mr. Obama to show these American patriots, who, like him, opposed the Iraq War from the start, the same respect they were shown by the president of Iran, who gave them his time and took their unfiltered questions. Let's Talk invites Mr. Obama to be the people's president and take the opposite tack of his predecessor, who not only refused to meet with anti-war patriots, but scorned their love of country. Last week in Washington, D.C., Code Pink visited the Syrian, Iranian, Cuban, Venezuelan, and Bolivian embassies to deliver doves, apple pies, flowers, and cards. All five countries have had strained relationships with the Bush administration. The Code Pink message to these embassies was, "Yes, we can live in peace. As you can see, we're ready for change. So tell us, President-elect Obama, now that you've taken office with your commitment to bring about change, when is a good time to talk?" Okay, my comment, if these actions interest you, you might get in touch with Code Pink. I'm sure they have a website. I'm not sure what it is, so you might try codepink.com or .org. There's another article I forgot to bring with me today, but it explains why Obama is courting the center and courting Republicans and ignoring the Democratic left and progressives, and that's because he feels like they're already in the bag. He's already got them, and they're not putting sufficient pressure on him to make the changes that they would like to see. So that is why, in their opinion, there's this continuing series of choices that reflect the center, not the left and not the progressives. And as I said before, his appointment in the financial realm is just absolutely more of the same. The same guys that got us into the mess he's hoping are going to get us out. Good luck. All right, we got a call. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hey, Shamba, it's Clearwater. I was wanting to talk to you about the air cars. Have you looked into that yet?
Nope.
The ones that run on compressed air?
Don't know anything about them.
You don't know anything about it? I'm amazed.
Oh, lots of things can amaze you about me. How about if you send me an article on it?
Oh, I'll send you all kinds of stuff.
No, just make them brief. If you send me too much, I can't get through it.
Okay.
All right.
I want to just let you know the website.
Why don't you send me that link?
Okay, I will.
Okay, chamba@kvmr.org.
I'll leave it in your mailbox.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Okay, and that that goes for anybody. If you want me to get involved in something, it really helps me if you send me brief articles, because if they're too lengthy, they're not suitable for the air, and I don't have time to really edit them down, and some of them are so wordy they can't be edited down. So please do send me things, but try and send me brief articles. chamba@kvmr.org. And then just a general thing, if you do want to phone in with comments or questions, I strongly suggest that you make some notes first so that when you're on the air, you don't panic and you can make your points cogently and effectively. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hi, Chamba. Say, in regards to the type of appointments that Obama is making, and a lot of them seem to be ex-Clinton and middle-of-the-road types and so on, we got to keep in mind that these middle or sort of even sort of upper-level administrators are merely administrators. They don't make policy, although if they have a president like Bush who doesn't pay attention to what's going on, they oftentimes get away with things.
Yeah.
And so it's quite possible, you know, somebody who's a general for Napoleon can swing around and be a general for King Edward XIV, you know. I mean, he can still be a good general. And if he's not extremely ideological, he's a technocrat. He does what he's told to do. And if he's competent and understands the system he's working with. And I think that's why Obama is picking some of these people who've been down the road.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been down a little different road than we'd like to see them go now, but at least they know which rocks not to trip over.
Well, one hopes.
Just because he's picking, in some cases, you might say, the same old faces,
right,
it doesn't mean that they're going to be following the same policies. That would just mean that Obama's not paying attention.
You make some very good points. The thing that concerns me is the underlying philosophy behind where they're operating out of.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, and I'm concerned about it just like you are.
Yeah, I mean, when he picks a former head of the Federal Reserve,
yeah,
and he picks him for anything, he is supporting the Federal Reserve system, bottom line.
It's really hard to know. I mean, I wouldn't know what to do. You know, what are they going to do? Tie them to stakes and set them and blaze them off? I mean, I
prefer telephone poles myself, but your point is well taken.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, right now, I no longer even know whether we are bailing out with the billions or the trillions or the quadruplians.
Yeah, and you know, it doesn't matter because they're printing the money anyhow. They're just cranking it out.
But somehow that's going to have a fallout in the future. You know, heavy-duty inflation or
of course.
It might be.
Well, I don't think they're thinking of the future. I think they're just playing save our ass now.
Well, I have a little bit more subversive, fearful point that they know pretty well.
Oh,
they
okay.
know that they and their buddies are not going to be particularly hurt. And they're going to let the rest of us just wallow in one form of misery or another.
That's a given.
And if we don't start, as you've mentioned a number of times, and a lot of other people are doing the same, that we've got to figure out a way to get together, form groups who are discussing and implementing our discussions through pressure to our congressmen and senators and to Obama.
Absolutely. Here's what I'd like to see from Obama. I would like to see him gather wise minds from across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you make a very valid point. He's gathering the wisest minds that he can find from a particular spectrum.
At least their experience.
Yeah.
I don't know if
exactly. At least their experience. But he's not going outside of that circle. He's not going to the universities. When John F. Kennedy came in, he brought in some quote intellectuals, some mm-hmm. Ivy Towered intellectuals that didn't necessarily had government experience, but they had ideas.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to see is Obama bring in people from across the spectrum and
mm-hmm.
say, let's look at this whole system.
Now, he may be doing that behind the scenes.
Oh, God knows what he's doing behind the scenes. All I know is what he's doing in public.
Well, and what if he actually did do the things that I think we both agree that he should do?
Right.
I'm not sure whether Americans know how to interpret it. I look to your program and many, many other type of progressive spokespeople are on the airwaves and also on the internet to enlighten and inform and educate people. It's just unfortunate. I mean, say, for instance, have you considered expediting the setting up of sort of affinity groups, people who have some similar interests and energy to pursue those interests, and get busy and get to work and figure out ways to put these ideas into action and then lay it out to our representatives? You could be an important spokesperson. You wouldn't have to put your head on the block to do it. You just have to, you know, people, tell people that they, if they get through to you, you will pass it on. It'll be sort of a public information forum. There's going to be a meeting next Tuesday, blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah, blah.
That is a terrific idea, and I personally don't have the time or energy to do that.
Well,
I wish there were someone that could do it.
You need to do some better drugs then, man.
You've
got to have
Send
energy.
Them on over, baby.
Well, we'll take care of business.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your call and your concerns.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Oh, hi.
You're live on KVMR.
Yeah. I did hear on NPR this morning that... that he was going to form an economic advisory council.
Okay.
And that Volcker was going to be heading it, but Obama was going to have people from labor and from universities and...
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very good news. I'm happy to hear that.
So I don't know who all they're going to pick for that.
Right.
Well, that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
So I was kind of... hoping something
good.
Like that would happen.
All right. Well, maybe
so we'll see.
Maybe things are brighter than I thought. Thanks
but
very
we
much.
We have to keep the pressure on. That's
absolutely
for sure. All right. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks for your call, caller. It's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Hello.
You're live on KVMR.
Okay, Shamba.
You're live on the radio.
Wasn't the last savings and loan debacle a huge money laundering scheme that we found out about years later?
Yes. You think this is the next one?
Nobody's looking there now.
Oh, there are people looking there, and if you go on the internet, you'll find articles that point that out. The question is, why isn't mainstream media looking at it? And the
same reason they didn't last time.
Right, they're implicit. They're complicit. Yeah.
All right.
All right, thanks for reminding us of the latest scam. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Yeah, the recent caller who talked about forming groups to
yes.
do something.
Yes.
If he could email you his how to get in touch with him, I would love to get in touch with him. That's all I have to say. I'd like to be part of such a group.
Terrific. I recognize the voice, and I know you're a force in the community, and you really do put your energy where your mouth is. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. So you need to contact me with your email, and the previous caller needs to contact me with his email, and I'll put the two of you together.
Hey, thank you very much.
And I can do that without any new drugs, too. All right.
Thank you.
Have a great Thanksgiving. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Hello? Caller, you're live on KVMR. Well, there's nobody there. Okay. No more callers, so we're back to me reading articles. And if anybody calls, I'm gonna hold until the end of this article. This is by... No, phone's live. Hi, you're live on KVMR.
Hi.
You're live.
Hey, I have a comment about our local government.
Sure.
And I'm not really privy to the sources of my information to be revealed, but I believe there's a plan in place to fluoridate the water in the county.
Which county are we talking about?
Nevada County.
Okay. All right. But so we have a rumor that Nevada County may be interested in fluoridating its water.
Yeah, and I believe there's... They're trying to gather support behind the scenes before they go public. so I wanted to just...
Okay, alert us. Okay, thanks very much for that heads up.
Thank you.
Yep. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
I'm live?
You're as live as you're going to be, baby.
Okay, this is what I have to say about electric cars. You know, you were talking about the little two-seaters and everything, okay?
Right, yep.
Nobody owns the batteries. The gas companies or whoever is charging the batteries owns the batteries. You pull in, down comes the battery pack, up comes the charged battery pack, away you go.
Excuse me, is this something you're proposing or this is something that already exists?
I'm proposing.
Oh, okay. All right, so that's your idea for a way to...
That's my big idea for the day.
All right, thanks very much. It's an interesting innovation. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no more phone calls. I'm going to try and read this article. It's by one of my favorite blogsters, Fred Reed. It's called Asleep at the Wheel, the U.S. Becomes What It Wasn't. The Pentagon, methinks, is out of control. We no longer have a military in service to the state, but a state in service to the military. Few notice because of the two ingrained habits of mind. First, we think of the president as just that, the president, the country's civilian governor, who, oh yes, technically the commander-in-chief. Technically, because he isn't really in the military and doesn't strut about in uniform with ribbons and feathers. He seems more a CEO than a general. Second, we tend to think of the military as a federal department under civilian control. The Pentagon carries out policy, we believe, but it doesn't make it. Would that it were so. The military today is hardly under civilian control. Note that Congress long ago gave up its power to declare war. This is crucial. Politically, it is far safer to acquiesce to a war than to declare one. In practical terms, the checks and balances in the Constitution no longer restrain the commander-in-chief, and thus not the soldiery. The Supreme Court has become a mausoleum. It might be replaced by a wax museum without anyone's noticing. The Pentagon is now the private army of any president who chooses to use it. Our foreign policy has been militarized. This is not just a matter of countless alliances and bases abroad. A few days ago, the military attacked Syria. This, an act of war, was a result not of national but of military policy. So far as I know, the attack was neither ordered nor authorized by Congress. The soldiers do as they please, and if we find out about it later. This is not civilian control. Such occurrences are inevitable when the military controls policy. Soldiers are truculent by nature, think quickly of military solutions, and need enemies to justify both their existence and their budget. Among recent consequences, attacking Syria, occupying Iraq and Afghanistan, bombing Pakistan, bombing Somalia, threatening Iran, threatening North Korea, encouraging Israel to bomb Beirut, arming Georgia, and aggressively expanding NATO to encircle Russia. Ominously, we now accept that the behavior of the armed forces is none of our business. Note the years of expectancy as we waited to see whether the commander-in-chief, a de facto six-star general, would attack Iran. I suspect that few realize how militarized the United States itself has become. The transformation has been inconspicuous. The Pentagon avoids undue attention, quietly has expanded its reach. Abolishing the draft was an important step, since it severed any connection between the upper levels of society and the armed forces. The educated don't much care what the army does as long as they don't have to help do it. The economy also has been militarized. Although the United States has no national enemies, it spends phenomenally on a martial empire whose only purpose is to be a martial empire. Add up the defense budget, and he puts defense in quotes, and then he says it was last used for defense in 1945. The war bills, FLAC programs, veteran administration budges, on, and you reach $1 trillion a year. A country in decline can't long waste so much money. Perhaps as important, the military cannot spend so much without gaining great, if unnoticed, political power. In particular, the production of hugely priced weapons has been woven into the economy to such an extent that it cannot be brought under control. Cancel the F-22, the JSF, and such like, and the economies of politically powerful states go into recession. None dare do it. Close big bases? Whole towns would shut down. The country has no need of such a military, and especially not of the formidably costly weapons. Having no plausible enemy of any sophistication, the Pentagon exercises itself by attacking primitive nations in the Third World and usually losing. For this, you do not need an F-22. You could lose as well with slingshots. The spectacle of an alleged superpower struggling to beat yet another collection of ragtag guerrillas may seem darkly comical, but winning or losing isn't the point. The endless wars keep the contracts flowing, the promotions coming, and fuel demands for a larger army. We would do well to bear in mind the dangers of excessive military influence in national life. Professional soldiers have little in common with the rest of the country. We like to think of them as our boys in uniform, the brave and the true and the patriotic defenders of democracy, and so on. It isn't so. The officer corps is authoritarian to the roots of its soul, has little use for democracy, and prides itself on blind obedience. Soldiers do not readily distinguish between dissent and treason. Further, they regard civil society as an unworkable anarchy of weaklings who lack the will to fight. The gap between military and civilian consciousness is huge. The ideal officer goes to a service academy where, in late and impressionable adolescence, he learns to walk in squares, always obey, and regards the polish of his belt buckle with insane concern. Thereafter, the only answer he knows is, "Yes, sir." To a civilian, the conformism, the lack of independence, and yes, the pride in the lack of, are incomprehensible. Then, for 30 years, the soldier spends most of his time with similar people and comes to believe that it is not just reasonable, but the best way to live. Like cops, soldiers tend to socialize amongst themselves because they fit awkwardly into civil society. Watch a colonel at a civilian cocktail party. He isn't sure whether he is a sir or Bob. And soldiers seek war. They will say they don't, of course. Can you imagine Tiger Woods spending 30 years practicing his golf swing without wanting to get into a tournament? The military mindset is not American, not cognizant with the ideals the country stands for, and to some extent achieves. Most imperfectly, yet genuinely, America has cherished dissent and eccentricity and freedom. Yes, I know about the intolerance of small towns, and I grew up in the South, but compare America at its worst to any military dictatorship, which is where we seem to be heading. Today, the Pentagon, again, Mr. Bush is the Pentagon, openly seeks domestic power. For example, and this is from Salon, Army combat troops will now be assigned, on a permanent basis, to engage in numerous domestic functions, including, as the article put it, quote, to help with civil unrest and crowd control, close quote. That is, the Pentagon will be able to crush dissent. One expects this from Guatemala, which we seem bent on becoming. Recall further that the Pentagon has been calling for the power to conduct domestic surveillance of the general population, as, for example, in its program of total information awareness. The NSA, CIA, the Commander-in-Chief are all military or paramilitary, and Homeland Security is very much in the vein of military dictatorships everywhere. The new rights of the FBI to spy on everything from library records to habits of travel fit the pattern well. The FBI is not military, but its behavior is authorized by the Commander-in-Chief. The lines are blurring. We're going to pay for this. That was Fred Reed. We're out of time. We've managed to go through another hour of essentially depressing news, but that's the state of our nation. Thank you for listening. And we'll talk at you next week. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. And most important, love the people you're with, love the people you're not with, and give thanks. Give thanks for what you have. And wish all those good things upon the rest of the world.